This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm honored to have in the studio with me Kalamu Yassalam, a New Orleans-based poet and playwright and musician and editor and political activist. Kalamu Yassalam is the author of, among other things, What is Life? Reclaiming the Black Blues Self. And he has edited several anthologies, including 360 Degrees, A Revolution of Black Poets. Kalamu Yassalam, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. I'm glad to be here.
Well, as one of the leading writers coming out of New Orleans, I wanted to talk to you first about Katrina. You were there when the hurricane hit.
I was there. I left Sunday, the day before the hurricane hit. And I believe that, like, probably 99% of the evacuees, it was just another hurricane. I mean, I'm 58, and I've lived in the city all my life except for 3 years when I was in the military. And hurricanes are a way of life in New Orleans. So you grab a bag and two or three changes of clothes, and you fully expect to be back in 2-3 days at the most. Sweep the water out and just keep on pushing. That's life in New Orleans.
Had you worried about the big one hitting before, though, or you hadn't given it a lot of thought?
Had not. I was aware of it, but did not really consider it as a reality. I guess I was like young people in death. when you're young, that people die, but you never think about it as you're going to die tomorrow or anything like that.
Was it hard to get out on Sunday? That was right before the...
That was the mandatory evacuation.
Mandatory evacuation.
We left early, but it took a while. In fact, I was not supposed to leave. My wife is an x-ray technician, works at the Veterans Hospital. And as a reference, it's across the street from Charity Hospital, which many people have heard about as a result of the reporting on Katrina. But there were bureaucratic snafus, so
she wasn't called in.
She was on call. Mm-hmm. She was supposed to go in, but whoever was handling the emergency roster did not include her name on the list. And if her name was not included on the list, she couldn't bring her family and this, that, and the other. I'd spent 2 other times on hurricanes. She was on call, so I'd been at the hospital when they happened. I didn't give it a second thought. And it was Tuesday afternoon, about midday, when I realized it was over. When I say it was over, that the city was underwater. I saw it on CNN. They were showing a montage of photographs. And there was one shot of the Circle Food store with water up to its doors, the top of the doors. And at that point, I knew it was over. It didn't mean much to, I guess, most people watching, but for those of us in New Orleans, that meant that the water had risen in areas where, in my lifetime, I'd never seen the water go that high. In fact, it's a fact of life that no one could have prepared emotionally for it because it's never happened before.
Kalamu Yassalam, when you say it's over, can you elaborate on what that meant to you and what your emotional reaction was at that time to see that kind of devastation?
It's sort of you believe it and you don't believe it. And it's so immense that you have no way of processing it. It's sort of like somebody saying, here's a gazillion dollars. No, here's $1 billion. $1 billion does not exist in any one place at any one time. It's too immense. And we as human beings have a limited capacity to deal with immensity. So that's why we can't understand space. That's why the Christians have a problem with evolution. Because it could just simply say, well, that's God's plan. Evolution is God's plan, the way God works. But what they have a problem with is the immensity of the time stretches and the changes. We have problems dealing with that. And I had a severe, I had a real problem dealing with that. It was really, that was it. When they report 80% of the city was underwater, it's a very misleading report. The city is divided by the Mississippi River. I happen to live on the West Bank. We did not have flooding on the West Bank. We had a lot of, you know, wind damage and everything because it was a hurricane. But we did not have flooding. It turns out, if you look at the map and then overlay it with population density, 80% of the residential areas of New Orleans were underwater, not 80% of the land area. The parts of the city that were underwater were the major areas where black people lived. And one of the problems of the media was because they were located where they were located and only where they were located, they had no concept of what the city was and what was going on. What we saw, whether we know it or not, was the decimation of the entire black community. So the professionals, teachers, doctors, lawyers, and so forth, a large, overwhelming percentage of them lived in the East and the Gentilly areas, both of which were underwater. So it was not just, although it may appear that way on television, the poor black people who suffered. I mean, the entire black community, the largest black financial institution, Liberty Bank, I think there were 8 branches and 5 were underwater, including their main offices and what have you. So when I saw where the water was, we're talking about some of the most exclusive enclaves of black wealth in New Orleans underwater, as well as you saw on television, the extreme poverty.
And was this just a fluke of the way the flooding happened, or what's your explanation for that?
This is historic in terms of the land, the geography of the land. The closer you are to the river, the higher the ground. But it's such a steep, as New Orleans has been described as a bowl and what have you, but it's such a steep incline, although it doesn't appear that way when you walk in the streets, it's such a steep incline. You have to be very close to the river to be safe. Well, all of that area was built out long ago, the French Quarter and what have you. The Garden District was built, Algiers Point. Those were the first areas that were built out. And, of course, those were the areas that were claimed by the wealthy. And then as the city grew, you build out further and further into what are basically marsh and swamplands. And there was no way to protect any of that, what's called New Orleans East, where 40% of the city population lived, where there was a community of over 12,000 Vietnamese, which, I mean, all of this has been lost. The New Orleans metro area had the largest concentration of Hondurans outside of Honduras. People just don't realize the immensity of what we were looking at. St. Bernard Parish, which is immediately adjacent to Orleans Parish of the county, is mostly poor whites and lower middle class whites. It was wiped out. Plaquemine Parish wiped out. You had whole fishing villages and towns completely gone. And so the immensity of the devastation was such that even the media could only deal with what was in front of them, and it didn't occur to them to do just a little bit of research and say, well, wait a minute. This man said 20 square miles of residential area. Surely there were more than just poor black people that lived in 20 square miles of residence. I remember a reporter asking a pilot, he said it was about 20 square miles. He said, oh, you mean 20 square blocks? He said, no, 20 square miles.
Even now, the enormity is hard to grasp. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Kalamu Yassalam, New Orleans-based poet, playwright, musician, political activist, editor, really one of the leaders of the New Orleans literary community. What did you make of the image that sticks in my mind, just of those poor people stranded on that highway or at the convention center or at the dome?
They were trying to kill us.
They were trying to kill you.
Yeah. They were trying to kill us.
You think it was a conscious effort?
I'm not a card-carrying Negro conspiratist, and I have a number of friends who are charter members, and I believe the explanation is much more structural in the society. And I think that there was also a factor that goes unspoken. The white people were afraid, including the soldiers. They were afraid of the black people in the city. The police force, which is one of the most corrupt police forces in the country, was under fire because the people who were remaining in the city had nothing to lose. And the police had been unmerciful, and people fought back. And when they got the reports that the police were under fire, I really think that the government blinked. They could have sent some forces in earlier, but I think they waited until they were sure they had massive numbers so that they wouldn't have to fight.
It was unbelievable watching to see that the media could get there and film these people, and these people couldn't get food or water.
At the convention center, the convention center is divided into sections, hall A, B, C, D, E, and they're still building it out. In hall A of the convention center, there was a National Guard battalion there, 200 and some troops, armed. They sequestered themselves in that area, parked dump trucks in front of the doors so that nobody could get in, and basically refused to deal with the situation. Whether people know it or not, there were 200, I think 230 something, I don't know the exact number, but it was over 200 armed National Guard at the convention center who refused to show themselves, who refused to leave the room. Why would they not leave that hall? They were barracked at that hall. Why did they not come out and, some people would say, enforce some order, but do something? I think it was real. There was a real fear. That's why you had the exaggerated reports of the violence and the sensationalism around the looting. There's a hidden fear in America, particularly among the authority figures of this society, that I believe they fear that what they have done to people around the world, that given a chance, those people will seek retribution upon them.
So this may even be a subconscious fear that they're not aware of.
Right. And I strongly believe, because nobody believes that you could be watching people starve to death on television for 3 days and it'd be brought to you live, and that there was no way to get food and water to in the United States, that there was no way to get food and water to those people. Nobody believes that. I don't ascribe to it was just, modern day Nazis or that kind of thing. I subscribe that it was far deeper and far more structural, and that the people in charge blinked.
And that includes the mayor, the governor, the president?
No, the mayor, it's much more, he didn't care.
Really?
Well, look, last year there was Hurricane Ivan, and people were in the Superdome. They knew what the situation would be if there was a hurricane. the prognosis was that the hurricane was going to hit New Orleans. They knew from last year exactly what they would have to deal with. What did they do to prepare to deal with it? Nothing. And whoever's in charge has to bear that responsibility. And when I say he didn't care, I mean he didn't care enough to say, look, we have to do something. He didn't control the school buses because the school buses are with the parish, and he's the mayor of the city, which is a municipal. He controlled, however, the regional transit authority, the public buses. Most of those buses were parked in low-lying areas and flooded out.
The images of those flooded buses is haunting, too, isn't it?
No, it's an example of incompetence. See, I get mad about it. I get angry, and I'm ready to fight, and I don't give any quarter to those who say, well, there was nothing that could have been done. I mean, this is something that they knew. And I'm saying knew not in the intellectual sense. I'm saying last year, which it was not reported, but last year when Hurricane Ivan came, people were, they used the Superdome as a shelter. They had a lot of problems. They also had a lot of problems with what they call the evacuation plan. And they figured out how to solve some of those problems. But they did nothing to prepare for the advent of people at the Superdome. And so once you do nothing, if you do nothing in preparation when there's a crisis, you're not prepared to respond. They had nothing to respond. And so all they could do was go into the hysterical, you know, woe is me, nobody could have predicted this. And that's not true.
Bush himself said no one could have predicted it. What's your reaction to how the president responded to this?
Alcoholics do not believe they're alcoholics unless they're forced to confront their illness. Bush is in severe denial about his inability to plan and to foresee anything. Bush really is a true believer in his own Bush speak. And his Bush speak has no reference to reality. And so, like most fundamentalists, religious fundamentalists, they fall back on to it's beyond the ability of any human being. This is God's work, and we just have to deal with it as it's handed to us. And the fact of the matter is that the Bush government cut the budget for the Army Corps of Engineers 4 years running, year after year, and refused to deal with the question of wetlands. Don't even get started talking about the environmental impact, the toxicity of the chemical plants and what have you. That's a whole nother issue. But they just refused to deal with it. And part of it is based in the fact that the Bush government is anti-science. They do not believe in making plans based on an organized and systematic assessment of the material reality.
Kalamu Yassalam, I want to take you back to what you talked about, Bush speak, because part of Bush speak, once he finally woke up to the fact that this was a huge disaster, was in his first speech to talk about this bold government response he was going to have to take on poverty and racism, two words he almost never mm-hmm. utters. But what's become of that now?
Well, first of all, I think the only reason he said it was because of international pressure. I do not believe that it was done for the benefit of the black and the poor. I believe it was because of international pressure. The international community was extremely upset with the United States. And most Americans have no idea of how upset they were. Governments were sending aid that was just turned back, refused, denied. The Swedes, I think it was the Swiss. It was either Switzerland or Sweden. I forget which one. Were sending a mobile water purification on a plane. The plane was denied landing rights. It goes on and on and on and on and on. And I think my take on all of this is, again, that we're dealing with somebody that doesn't believe in science. And once you have that person in charge of the most powerful country in the world, and a country whose whole the lifestyle of this country is dependent upon science. People don't realize. They take for granted walking in a room and flipping a switch and electricity is there.
But now the rebuilding process is something more pernicious than just anti-science is going on. I saw one Republican legislator from Louisiana, I believe his name is Richard Baker of Baton Rouge, say, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did."
Mm-hmm. But you'll notice that he's saying we did it. And they ascribe this to the work of God. And I'm saying that God must be, their God must be cross-eyed, because the fundamentalists, you ought to hear it in the South, some of the fundamentalist preachers are saying the reason that it hit New Orleans was because of all of that sin and fornication and gambling and the homosexuality that is rampant in New Orleans, except the casino was not damaged, except the French Quarter, which has the largest concentration of homosexuality, stripping and all night, 24 hour revelry with alcohol did not flood. And so if quote unquote God was going after the homosexuals and the gamblers and the fornicators, why spare the heart of those areas of activity and hit poor residential areas? I mean, you know, the stupidity and the concurrence of stupidity, fundamental religion, anti-science, capitalism, and just raw greed will create a disaster every time. And that's what we were witnessing. And see, I don't think it was just black, you know, white on black. I don't think it was just race, because thousands and thousands of poor whites were wiped out, and they didn't even report it.
What's going to happen in New Orleans, Kalam Yassalam?
The city as we knew it is over. It's done. It's gone. That's finished. I don't think they're going to rebuild New Orleans. You heard it here first. This whole discussion about rebuilding New Orleans is being done as part of the government way of obfuscating reality. The reality is New Orleans as they want it doesn't have to be rebuilt, because it's still standing. The French Quarter is there. The Central Business District is there. The Garden District is there. The University District is there. Algiers is there. So the enclaves of power, the enclaves of mainstream society, which given that this is predominantly a white society numerically and certainly a white-dominated society in terms of the power structure, they have what they need to live and continue New Orleans and continue their version of New Orleans. So the Mardi Gras crews that parade as part of the white power structure, and this is people understand Mardi Gras, but it reflects all the way up and down the line the power structures and the communities of New Orleans. The white power structure, those Mardi Gras crews will be able to roll. The Mardi Gras Indians will not be able to roll because their neighborhoods are gone. So that what some people would call Black Mardi Gras Carnival, that's not going to be able to happen. But Rex will be able to roll. Bacchus will be, and they will do it, because they don't have to rebuild those parts of New Orleans. And the other parts of New Orleans, they're going to debate about it, and they're going to decide. And meanwhile, people have to live. And
well, what's going to happen to those people who were living in New Orleans?
The majority of them will find a way to survive in other parts of the United States. Some of them will return. A smaller percentage will return. And an even smaller number are going to commit suicide.
Really? Are you seeing any signs of increased suicide rate this early after?
One of the signs that we've seen, a number of people have died. Austin Leslie, who was the chef on his restaurant, his former restaurant, was the model for Frank's Place, that was a television show about 15 years ago. He was evacuated to Atlanta, and he died there about a week and a half, ago.
By suicide or some other cause?
No, they said it was probably a heart attack. But people just can't stand that pressure. I mean, it's one thing for somebody in your family to lose everything. A tornado hits the house or whatever. The extended family can come together and support that. But when the whole family, the whole extended family, everybody you know in your family and all your friends have lost everything, it's devastating.
Kalamuya Salam, do you plan on going back? Have you been back? What are your plans?
It's funny. I say that I'm not. I go to New Orleans frequently because I'm going around the country to where the people of New Orleans are and interviewing people. And for me, it's the city is mostly the people. My wife has been back to the house. As I say, we lived in the West Bank. She's been back twice. We're relocated to Nashville, but she's been back twice. I haven't been back yet. I do plan to go back for November 11th, 12th, and 13th. In our own crazy way, we're having homecoming for the high school where I was working and a couple of other public high schools. And we're trying to be as defiant as we can. The school board recently voted to make all the existing public schools on the West Bank into charter schools. And prior to that, they had already made two high schools on the East Bank that were not damaged. They had turned those into charter schools. So this is going to be an experiment in public education where you don't have public education. And this is, I think that what is significant about all of this is not the disaster that Katrina wrought, but the aftermath, because I think this is the future of America. We're going to see the first 21st century American city. New Orleans, the new New Orleans, is going to be planned. It's going to be methodically put in place. They're going to do it within 4 or 5 years. And so what that looks like is what the future of urban America is going to be. It's not a pretty sight.
No, it isn't. I would like to end, if you could just do that short poem that you've got about beauty, since we've been talking about a lot that's not beautiful. And Kalamuya Salam, since you're a great poet, I want you to read that poem.
Well, I don't know if I'm a great poet. And I was accused of being gloomily pessimistic by a writer from the what's that paper?
I've got it on
Boston Globe.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can say is I far missed the mark in terms of I never would have thought of turning all the public schools into charter schools.
Well, they'll think anything. So
yeah. Be about beauty. As strong as a flower is, be about beauty. Yet as soft too. Be about beauty, as soft as an open petal receiving the mist of a midnight raindrop. Be about beauty. Be about beauty, no matter life's dirt. Be about beauty. Be about beauty, strong as a flower. Be about beauty, soft too, as an open petal receiving the mist of a midnight raindrop. Be about beauty, no matter life's dirt. Be about beauty.
Well, that's going to be the last word. Thanks so much, Kalamuya Salam, for being my guest today.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.